So I'm here with Mark Branson. Mark, thank you so much for meeting with us. Thank you for doing this interview. I really appreciate it. Mark is the author of Memories, Hopes, and Conversations, Appreciative Inquiry and Missional Engagement and Congregational Change. It is now in second edition, 2016. Mm-hmm. It's recently published. So we thank you a lot. You're an expert and something that we're learning about here at missiology.com. And so I have some questions for you. We're going to use AI to talk about AI. Are you using appreciative inquiry to talk about appreciative inquiry?
I need to say that most often I'm asking the questions rather than answering them on this. So this is fun.
Excellent. Think back through your experiences with the study of appreciative inquiry. I want you to recall a time that was a high point for you, a time when you felt especially engaged, alive, motivated. What happened? Tell us about that.
Well, there was obviously a lot of motivation just at the discovery level for me. So I was in Asia, first in Bangkok and then the Philippines on something totally unrelated, I thought. These were gatherings of urban missiologists. And in a conversation in Thailand, someone mentioned an appreciative inquiry project there. And a new acquaintance, a friend, Athena Grosby, who's in the Philippines, talked about her project in Manila, and that's where I was heading next. And so here I was in Asia learning about an approach to gratitude and change that was taking place in other cultures. Hmm. And that just gets my attention.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so what Athena's project was getting the deans of the Catholic mainline and evangelical seminaries together for meals using AI questions. And there was nothing that crossed these borders normally. Mm. But it ended up being very collaborative, new relationships, friendships, activities. Mm. And so it was easy for me to see, here's a way in which language works. And I already was a student of Language House, how language works. And I had recently completed a doctorate in multicultural and international education. So all these things were swimming in my mind. And then to see on the ground really bright woman leading a process with men, deans of seminaries in Asia. Mm. So that's motivating, obviously. Yeah. Yeah. And so when I came back to the U.S., and we were in the middle of a move, taking the job at Fuller, and we were into a church that eventually became the subject of the book that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. So here was a situation where we saw a church really needing different conversations. And as soon as we started rolling out just some very tentative approaches, it just caught on with a lot of energy, mm-hmm. as I describe in the book. So that whole initial stage was motivating. I'm in the midst of finding every book I can. I want to understand the theory. But it really was the stories, the practice that just created a lot of energy for me. And I ought to mention one other really high point for me, and it's fairly recently. I've been in the middle of several years of some projects in Korea. And in one particular church that has organized itself, large church, 20,000 plus members, they already were working with a cell structure. So members are in cell groups. And what they started doing then, what we were doing as consultants, was helping several of these cells, 16 of them I think, where they were starting to learn just some new basic ways to talk to their neighbors. So we were trying several things. We spent a day then with all of those lay people and a couple of dozen pastors from the church. And all we asked was, what are some ways that you have seen God show up in these new practices? And it was 6 hours of testimony. It was just the most basic, what are you seeing? What are you loving? What are you... And so just the energy out of that, and the clergy came up to us and said, how did you do that? Yeah. How does that happen in a day, a whole day of testimony, mm-hmm. when all you did was ask a couple of questions? Mm-hmm. And it was that power of appreciative questions that make that work. Now, obviously, they'd been engaging God. They'd been prayerfully engaging God. So AI doesn't... it's not magic. It's simply bringing out, what do you see in the midst of what you're doing to engage God? And so those were both really high points for me.
One of the quotes from your text, Memories, Hopes, and Conversations, again, printed recently in its second edition in 2016, is the thesis you say that you quote in the introduction, the thesis of appreciative inquiry is that an organization such as a church can be recreated by its conversations. Conversations matter. And that's part of the essence of appreciative inquiry. Mm-hmm. The conversations shape our understanding of the world. They shape our practices, and the other way around as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But this is a key tool, right? Conversations are a key tool that are often perhaps not used enough
mm-hmm.
By congregations or mm-hmm. by organizations. So thank you for mm-hmm. doing this conversation mm-hmm. with us.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. Let's go on to another question for you. This is a question, again, that we're trying to bring to the foreground, encouraging motivating memories, which is part of what AI is trying to do constantly.
Mm-hmm.
Let's think about the most positive aspects of what's gone before and carry that with us into the future. So the second question is about, I'd like you to recall a situation of transformative change in an organization in which appreciative inquiry was a key matter. And I want you to describe how your use of, or somebody's use of appreciative inquiry had positive consequences. So unpack this for us. Help us, tell us some stories.
Most of my work with AI is in congregations. And so those are the easiest stories for me to come up with. And your question points at something that takes longer than the initial advancement. So when you first start AI, often you can create a lot of energy. And one of the biggest barriers I've found is when churches simply love that energy and thrive on it and don't do anything with it, right? So I'll often talk about the difference between appreciative questions, which is just that, and appreciative inquiry, which is actually a fairly formal process that runs through 5 steps, and those are all described in the book. And so I want to talk about some situation where they really would run through that loop more than once to where even the process became embedded in the organization. And this was in a church that was actually doing fairly well. The church, one of the churches, the backbone of the book, was one that was struggling at the time we began the process. But this other one was one that actually was fairly well, it was healthy, it was paying its bills, there were all generations there, there was some ethnic mix that was significant. So all of those things that were just actually by outward appearance, they're as healthy as any church would be, as well as they had their own challenges. And they were feeling those too. But rather than, and we'd first been asked to help them do problem solving. And basically, most of the time, what I say is, and we get into this in the book, if you focus on putting your energy into the problems, that becomes your reality. Now, it isn't that the problems That's can right. always be dismissed, but I definitely want the assets of an organization, the good news of the organization, to be the powerful environment in which you're solving problems. Mm-hmm. And so we just did some very basic questions, like the ones that are laid out in the book, and started that with some of the leaders, and then the leaders were interviewing more members. And as then they would gather after church during coffee hour, and instead of just generic buzz, which has its own huge benefits, actually, mm-hmm. but instead they spent about 20 minutes saying, what's going on in these conversations? How are you all doing with this? And there was all kinds of banter that started happening. We never knew so-and-so did this. We never knew you were involved in that. We mm-hmm. never knew. So it just created, in this group of people who knew each other, storytelling of stories they didn't know about each other.
Mm-hmm.
But not only that, but they were starting to talk about neighbors. Now, it's not unusual in U.S. churches for church people to not be more than thinly engaging their neighbors. Churches quickly turn inward. They become primary friendships there. Mm-hmm. They'll move outward in programs, but they generally don't just kind of generally say, I really want to have relationships up and down my block or up and down the hallway of my apartment building. And there were a few people that were doing that,
mm-hmm.
that were having, you know, a beer with a neighbor or mowing somebody's lawn or baking bread. And those were creating conversations and sometimes creating amazing avenues for the Spirit to prompt something much deeper than just a beginning friendship.
Yeah.
Those stories started coming out over those coffee hours.
Mm.
And so all this is saying that all it took was prompting stories and listening for stories at all levels of the organization to shift.
Mm.
And no surprise, missions committees, evangelism committees aren't the primary place these things are going on.
Yeah.
And so the church started rethinking, maybe we don't need an evangelism committee, we just need a way, an avenue for stories to get told.
Mm.
And so over a period of 2 years, what they also were saying is that there's ways that these new relationships with our neighbors are helping us understand justice better because we've started to understand some injustice in our neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Let's work with them. So instead of the missions committee sitting back and saying, how do we get involved in justice activities? Mm-hmm. It was neighbors learning about, in this situation, some immigrant neighbors and another place, some violent issues in the neighborhood mm-hmm. that needed, that there were some police problems and they needed to be dealt with. So there were a number of stories that were coming up, new avenues, new relationships that led to, you know, the provocative proposals, the new dreams. Mm-hmm. So it's that over a period of 2 to 3 years that the church restructured its committees, restructured how it used its time. Sermons and other things started reflecting this. So that's where the change goes through the whole organization.
That's excellent. And one of the things you mentioned, and you just mentioned this very briefly at the beginning, you said we were invited in for problem solving,
mm-hmm.
right? And part of why AI generates so much energy is that it does relieve a group of these kind of technical expectations, right? That leaders are expected to be problem solvers, right? Leaders are expected in situations to, you know, come up with plans, strategy, and solve problems. And yet AI, you came in and started asking questions, and it ended up being a very different approach to a transformation in that community.
Yeah. And the problems, you know, in these churches, they can be budget problems, they can be arguments over what is evangelism, they can be personnel issues. I mean, all churches have these kind of things going on. But you're better off working at them when, in fact, you recognize what God's doing and you're putting most of your energy in there. I can remember in a church in Hawaii where a good friend, a pastor, had invited me. He said, just would you sit in on our board meeting and then just give us 10 minutes at the end? Mm-hmm. And I don't do that often, but he was a good friend. I said, yeah, I'll do it. And they spent, at the end of it, he says, Mark, do you have anything to say? I said, yeah, you spent 90% of your 2 hours on problems mm-hmm. and 10% on a couple of things going well.
Yeah.
If you would reverse that yeah. for several months, get back to me. And he literally just kind of slapped his notebook on the desk. He says, we are willing to pay almost anything for that.
Yeah.
He says, that's exactly the word yes. we needed. I didn't charge them just because this is long-term relationships and I wasn't doing an awful lot of work, but
that's a fantastic example. Thank you for sharing that. Mm-hmm. So let's move on to another question. Mm-hmm. We can come back to this. If you think of other stories, feel free to jump on back, but this next series of questions, I want to surface some of these core aspects, some of these things that make appreciative inquiry so important and so valuable. So here's my first one. How has appreciative inquiry contributed to your understanding of mission praxis? So perhaps recall for us some specific examples of how appreciative inquiry has shaped your thinking and actions with regard to understanding God's mission and our partnership and participation in his work.
Yeah, a lot of that goes to the heart of the shift from the first to the second edition of the book. The book was written around a particular domestic church. It was a Japanese-American church. And while there were some missional directions going on in there that came up in the AI and in the wishes and the new practices, it wasn't a major theme through the book. And because I teach in missiology and I teach in missional ecclesiology, that was a concern to me. But when Al Roxborough and I started teaching a series of D-Men cohorts here at Fuller, we introduced students to appreciative inquiry. And what we saw start happening with our encouragement was that appreciative inquiry also became the way to talk to a neighbor. Everything from, you know, when this doesn't need to be awkward, you're just having a beer with a neighbor. What do you like about this neighborhood? Mm-hmm. How long have you lived here? What do you think this community is doing well with kids? Mm-hmm. What do you think it's doing well with elderly?
Yeah.
So it's a very easy way simply to talk, and you actually, it moves you toward new collaborations. Mm-hmm. So as we saw these projects, that's what ended up prompting me finally to have enough new stories, new data, new research to publish the second edition. Mm-hmm. And so the whole middle five chapters of the new edition are chapters by Fuller grads who used appreciative inquiry both internally in the organization and externally with their neighbors. And then Nina and I, my wife and I, had increasingly been mixing some missional ecclesiology transformation processes with appreciative inquiry. And so in part 3 of the book, we actually spell out the types of processes we used in a number of churches around that way. So that's, for me, these things really belong together because what pulls them both together is that God is the active agent. And so it's gratitude for that that makes the missiological shift a normal one.
Yeah. How do we gain awareness of what God is doing in our midst, in our neighbor? We got to ask questions, right? We need to be, and we need to ask the right kinds of questions, right? They need to be questions of, we know God is working, let's find the ways how, right? So we're not asking questions about problems, we're asking questions about evidence of his grace, right? Where do we see people loving each other? Where do we see the you know, our community, our neighborhood moving towards justice, moving towards shalom?
Exactly, exactly.
So one of the other differences that one of the other shifts that you mentioned in the introduction to the second edition is a shift in emphasis or a shift in timing for experiments. Can you briefly unpack that for us?
Yeah, it's not unusual for academics to ask for way too long and too complex of a process. And so both in the work that I'd been doing with Al Roxborough and others on missional transformation and the work of AI and how often those were coming together, we started learning that the quicker we could move to simple experiments, then God would run with that. I mean, I don't know how to do this other than just to say God's the active one here, that we don't need a lot of developmental time to try something and come back with what ends up being testimony in my tradition. And so that was something that was a shift, that you just don't need to go through a lot of the careful procedural. I mean, I do want current procedures, but you can move to experiments in a lot of ways much more quickly.
Which gives you then a chance to come back and do reflection.
Right.
Right. Continue the conversations, continue the appreciative inquiry kind of questions now that you've done something together. You've practiced it. Where did God show up? How did that work out? You know, do we want to tweak this and do it again?
Right. And you're doing that while, as we show in parts of the book, and most of those, the middle five chapters too, they were doing Bible study, lectio readings of texts. They were reading other books. So your reflective capacities are being increased both by scripture and by your own theological tradition. And all of that is helping you see, in fact, what's going on in the midst of the questions you're engaging, both emic and etic in your AI work.
So the second question in this series of questions aiming at kind of core aspects, what makes appreciative inquiry important, unique, valuable, I want to ask about your valuable contribution. So what do you see as the most valuable ways that your own research has contributed to the practice and the study of appreciative inquiry?
That just came out of the trajectory God took me on, that I was discovering appreciative inquiry in the midst of what was already engagement with the North American, North Atlantic missional church conversation. So it was starting to see that on the ground in study with students, in books, by missional church, missional ecclesiology, which has become kind of so amorphous that it's lost a lot of its meaning. But I'm after several very specific things, and I can talk about those as theological drivers, that God is the primary agent, that our neighbors are humans and they're subjects, they're not objects, which means listening matters. Otherwise, we're not going to know what God is up to. And ecclesiology is a local. Clement Sedmak wrote a book called Doing Local Theology, and I'm talking about doing local ecclesiology, that ecclesiology is actually does need to be reshaped as we engage God on the ground with our neighbors, something you see in the New Testament all the time. And so those theological drivers for me, it was bringing together these new emphases and what we were discovering in missional ecclesiology with appreciative inquiry that focuses so much on alterity. What's the voice of the other? How does God use the other to change us? Because so much of church outreach is, how do we help other people become like us? And it seems to me that the alterity issue needs to convert us. And appreciative inquiry is one way that that happens. And so I think it's the bringing together those two. And it also then affects all of the discernment capacities of a church. So if God's primary agent, we confirm that. If humans are subjects, not objects, if we're doing local ecclesiology, then the church's discernment becomes primarily around what is God doing and how do we participate, rather than organizational development. How do we pay for and build this stuff so that we're delivering the right goods and services?
That is such a significant shift. The recognition that they're humans and therefore we should listen. The recognition that God is active in their lives before we arrive.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and we can all say that as missiologists, we're, you know, we're well aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
But does it actually affect our praxis when it comes to, you know, sharing faith
mm-hmm.
and sharing the gospel? One of the assumptions about appreciative inquiry and the way that it's used in your text and the way that you've promoted it as part of PhD studies and DMin studies at Fuller Theological Seminary is indeed it's the assumption, right, of there is grace at work. The Holy Spirit is at work.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and we're not just bringing the Holy Spirit, we're not just bringing God's grace with us as we enter this neighborhood. The Spirit's already working. Mm-hmm. Our job is to get on board
mm-hmm.
and participate with what the Spirit is doing, and how can we do that unless we're asking
right, exactly right.
those questions,
mm-hmm.
looking for grace.
Yeah, and so that leads into the epistemology question of that gratitude actually gives you access to meaning that you can't get at otherwise. And it has to do with heart. It has to do with actions, awareness, attentiveness, all those things. But recognizing meaning when you run into it. So when a neighbor says something, are you listening closely enough to the stories behind the words so that you actually are learning things that you couldn't have learned otherwise? Not just about the neighbor, but about God.
That's huge. So, and that's the beginning of an answer to this question, and maybe you can unpack it in different ways if there's other things that you'd like to share about it. But what are the most important aspects of appreciative inquiry that perhaps make it unique as a qualitative research method? So this is something mm-hmm. that, in fact, you have encouraged this in PhD students. I mean, you're mentoring me in my own dissertation currently using appreciative inquiry as a qualitative research method.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of those things that make appreciative inquiry unique?
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I love it, because it is gaining new knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. So it's pretty unpredictable. There are ways to do quantitative and qualitative research where your questions create too tight of a limit on what you're going to learn. Now, I can answer a yes-no question. Obviously, that's going to have very limited new knowledge for me. I can ask a broad question. Tell me about your culture. And because it's so broad and you ask that of 20 people, you're going to have so much data that it's not going to be useful research. And so instead, appreciative inquiry is getting genuine new data. And yet it is focused, because it's focused on something that the other person values, sees, and then may or may not, depending on your research project, attribute to God. Mm. So whether it's in asset-based community development, which is a cousin of appreciative inquiry, where you're learning about a community's resources, and it's a fairly normal way then to build collaborations, or just even in just relationships with neighbors. There's so many ways to use AI in research, whether for students or for professionals, that it is just a huge, what we would call a mother load of data, but it can be confined enough, if you're asking good questions, to actually create questions that you can work with, where the data is, the processing of the data, the interpreting of the data, does produce something that becomes new knowledge.
In appreciative inquiry, stories in particular are important. Can
mm-hmm.
you help us understand why?
Well, this is, I think, one of the reasons why it works so well across cultures. Because I don't know of a culture that doesn't tell stories.
Right.
Now, some tell them more rambunctiously and longer. Others tell them more internal to a family. Some tell them more in a neighborhood. So there's all kinds of differences in how we tell stories. But we all tell stories.
Mm-hmm.
And we all have different rules about our stories. How tight to an actual occurrence, how much freedom is there to embellish, all of those things. But any culture knows its rules, at least they're swimming in it. And one of the fun things I've found working across cultures with this is just those differences, because it helps those of us that work cross-culturally, mm-hmm. we start learning the difference of storytelling
yeah.
across cultures. But it does take, as I'd said earlier, that epistemology is a matter of not only do you hear the words, but you're starting to see the lives behind the words. You're seeing something much larger than that first offering of sentences and grammar.
Mm-hmm.
And so as it lets you ask more questions that get you into, in my theology, again, the access to what God's doing. I mean, this is what the Paul or the Peter Cornelius story or the Paul woman in Philippi story. All of these are stories to where something was going on that was not expected on the part of the professional Christian. Mm-hmm. And every time they had to learn and see something new, or they were going to miss what God is up to.
One of the questions that we've had with regard to using appreciative inquiry with this particular podcast is, you know, well, the AI is particularly used in, you know, the context of organizations, churches, you know, neighborhoods, existing communities. And we at Missiology.com and Missiology Podcast believe that in many ways, missiology and those who are practitioners and scholars do form a kind of a community, a loose community, but we're talking to each other, we're responding to one another. And it is one of the reasons why we chose to use this particular qualitative research method, because we're not just wanting stories or just wanting new knowledge. We are wanting to shift the conversation, right? We'd like mm-hmm. to see us take the best of what's come before and move forward into the future with those things, building on the strengths, building on the areas where there is grace evident. And because of the intentionality with which it seeks to change, so it is about gaining new knowledge, but mm-hmm. that impetus, right, that goal of actually shifting and transforming an organization has received criticism from other practitioners of different kinds of qualitative research, saying, well, that's not legitimate, right? You're going in and you're wanting to change things, not just observe passively and objectively. So how would you respond to that, someone who came to you and said, you know, AI isn't really qualitative research in a formal sense?
So the two categories that it fits are action research, which is a valid way to do research, and that's exactly what we're doing. It's saying that the person who's running the research is actually creating an environment that's going to lead to new actions. Mm-hmm. And it's participatory research, again, depending on the role of the researcher. Is the researcher in the midst of the change or in some way just outside it while something's going on? So both action research and participatory research are well-respected areas of qualitative research, and this fits with both of those.
So this last kind of question in AI is about generating, you know, dreams. It's about thinking and generating imagination about the future and helping put a little bit of flesh on that. If you can imagine it, it's easier to move in that direction, right? It's easier to embody. It's easier to start practicing things that move toward that. So that's why typically the last question in an AI interview has to do with dreams, hopes, imagination about the future. The question that I'm going to ask you is, describe three wishes for missional engagement, mission theology, as they relate to appreciative inquiry, and unpack those for us. Describe what these wishes perhaps look like as they come true.
Let me start with the academy, where a good part of my life is, both master's and PhD and other doctoral programs. I'm convinced that appreciative inquiry is, first of all, a fairly easy way to help students understand action research, participatory research. And you can do it without leaving the classroom, because students can do it with each other, in the class, with the professor, as long as the professor is up for changing. So I use it frequently in my classes about the class itself. It's also something that fits a challenge that we have in classes when we're teaching research methods, and we have, for us, a 10-week quarter, other schools a 15-week semester. What research can you do that's going to quickly get approval from human subject review committees and where the students can actually go do something? And appreciative inquiry tailored well can do that, to where the students get permission, sometimes just for interviewing other students, sometimes for being in their own church interviewing. You can get fairly quick permission around some very basic questions to get into the first steps of AI. How do you develop questions? Now, you don't have a chance to do a full AI process. You're not in a 10 weeks normally. Mm-hmm. Going to develop the competencies and the move toward actual new experiments. Mm-hmm. But you can still start to see how that might happen. Mm-hmm. So with the professor's stories, with the book, with the student's initial engagement, students get motivated and energized to try this. So the Academy is one of my first ones to see it taught and experienced as a method among students. Another one would be missiologically. Mm-hmm. And I want to look both inside mission organizations as well as outside. So inside mission organizations, appreciative inquiry can actually help mission organizations rethink, rediscover, go through transformation about their own life. Recently, I worked alongside a doctoral student, Wendy Smiley, who inside the organization, the mission organization World Horizons, was using appreciative inquiry to look at how they're doing coaching of missionaries and just came up with amazing stories, changes, encouragement across a system.
Yeah.
So for me, obviously, most of us would say, yeah, God's at work in mission organizations, but we very seldom take the time across a system to discover and to adapt in the way God's moving. And then beyond that, it's actually then what's happening outside in the way that the organization and its missionaries are meeting the world of their context. So that was what we were seeing begin to happen in the Korean laypersons group that I had talked about. But also, I recently had a half a day with a group of about a dozen Korean pastors. And again, they were just in the very earliest stages of using basic conversations with their neighbors. And we had talked about appreciative inquiry as doing a way to do that, but we mainly were using appreciative inquiry with them. Mm-hmm. And we found out they were also using some appreciative inquiries with shopkeepers, teachers at school, people in the neighborhood, neighbors. But when we gathered, I was simply supposed to do about a 30 to 60 minute quick check-in before we got into our two-day seminar. And so I just used an AI question, what are some good things going on in what you've experienced the last 3 months? Are there ways you're seeing God at work? Are there ways you're experiencing God's grace? A little over 3 hours later, of nothing but absolutely amazing testimony. And the testimony sometimes were about something that happened with a neighbor. Most of the testimonies were about what was going on in their families, with spouses, with kids, that their new listening to neighbors and discovering the Spirit of God in that were helping these pastors develop new listening practices in their families. Mm. And it was just, I mean, there were tears.
Yeah.
It was just a, you know, great praise to God of seeing how the Spirit of God was at work. And it, since then, has continued to lead toward more and more ripples of that. So it's the inside organizations, the organization as it encounters the world, the way that the Spirit is actually changing us when we're in the middle of an AI process, all of those are going on. So that's what I'm wanting to see happen more, that these kind of experiences, check-in, reflection, new experiments, would continue to roll out.
Well, Mark, I want to say thank you once again for letting us into your mind, into your scholarship, the things you've been writing about, and the ways that you've been connecting AI. This is especially a blessing to us at missiology.com, the way that you've been explicitly bridging AI and mission theology, AI and missional ecclesiology. This makes a difference and should make a difference for us on the ground. When we're engaging neighbors, right? When we're thinking about our mission organization. So thank you for helping us see those connections. And, you know, one of the things that has stood out to me, Mark, and maybe you could even address this a little bit, but on the Enneagram, you call yourself an 8, right? You mentioned that I'm
yep,
an 8 on the Enneagram.
It's true.
Right? The AI does not come
anybody
naturally.
Anybody that knows me.
Been, it's a discipline for you, right? This
right.
is a practice. This has been. Right. Tell us about that. What's that like?
Well, yeah, anyone that, it's easy for anyone to look up Enneagram on the web, and an 8 is one who automatically counters what we hear. Mm-hmm. So my initial impulse is always, you're wrong. And I'm going to show you that you're wrong. And that kind of initial hermeneutic of suspicion, it's got real advantages in some ways in academic work, but it absolutely does not shape me to see what God's up to and even to see the wonder of the people around me. And so this is a discipline, and it actually it's become more natural over the years, just that I know I need to look for, ask these kind of questions, pursue these kind of this kind of the graces around me. But yeah, it's not something that I'm. Nobody's going to tell you, Mark's a nice guy, and that's why he does AI. That's just not.
He's just appreciative by nature.
That's not where I come from.
Of course, he teaches AI.
So
right?
It really was a gift from God to stumble into this, and I think God's timing was for me to discover right as I was moving from 30 years of pastoral and other community work and into an academic environment, which can be hyper hermeneutics of suspicion. That and by no means is this normative yet, so anybody that knows me knows this does not always come out. But anyway, I do think it's been a gift from God to be able to walk into this.
Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, thank you, Martin.